welcome to Total Engagement with me, Matt Kuhn, a fan just like you who somehow found his way into a podcast. And I appreciate the growing numbers, the growing downloads, really starting to catch fire here. Thanks to all of you out there. We know there's a lot of podcasts. I know there's a lot of podcasts out there that are competing for your listening time. And I am dedicated to giving you the best show I possibly can. And I'm so appreciative of those of you who listen and interact, as well as please giving 5-star reviews on iTunes and interacting with me on Twitter at Matt Kuhn Music, or for the show at Matt Kuhn TE. Again, Total Engagement with Matt Kuhn on the MLW Network, and of course partners with our friends over at WrestleZone, the world's most read wrestling website. We are going to have a great show for you today. Now, I promised you I'm not going to miss another show. I was a day late, and I got to tell you, my life is busy. My job, my day job, my music school, during the summer we have music camps. I'm with kids all day long, a lot of times from 7:30 in the morning till 7:30 at night. And I got back from vacation at Myrtle Beach, and I had to kind of hit the ground running, so I couldn't do one last night, but I made time to do one tonight because there are a couple things I definitely wanted to talk about. Of course, we had a great episode last week. Mikey Whipwreck and Jerry Lynn. Fucking Mikey Whipwreck and fucking Jerry Lynn. The new effing show. Two ECW legends, two great guys, two guys who have an awesome podcast called Front Row Material. They're hilarious. They're funny. Mike Freeland, their co-host, I think is one of the best podcast hosts going today. And we did a little, you know, crossing of the streams, if you will. I was on their show and they were on my show, and I was honored to have them, and I asked them all kinds of questions. Great feedback. But something that kind of shocks me is people sometimes just want to hear from me. And so I do try to line up interviews. But at the same time, I am honored that you guys care about my takes and you guys interact with me. And last week was no exception. Loved having Mikey and Jerry on. An honor for sure. But this week, first thing we're going to talk about is all the stuff that happened outside WWE and the AEW bubble this past weekend in the world of wrestling. Now, I know a lot of you may not know about other wrestling going on. A lot of you may be old school wrestling fans looking for something new to watch, or wrestling fans, what they call lapsed fans, who don't really watch anymore and think wrestling sucks now. Let me tell you, there's a lot of good wrestling and a lot of different wrestling out there. I'm going to tell you about all the stuff I watched this past weekend. Yes, I did watch wrestling on my vacation, and I'll tell you what, I'm with my son. When I'm with my son, we watch wrestling. We love it. It's what we do. It's a good time. And we watched a lot of different stuff. And then I watched a couple more things when I got home in preparation for this show. And I got to tell you, I'm glad I did. And then in my, I guess it's my quest to be hated by everybody, we're going to touch about something that everybody loves to talk about. We are all so comfortable and so eager to address this subject in today's world: race. We love talking about race and racism, especially white people. White people love talking about race. We really don't. There is a term called white fragility, and it refers to the fact that white people often aren't comfortable talking about race, or they say things like play the race card. And I do want to say and ask you maybe to open your mind and maybe not just close off this whole subject without listening and maybe giving some ear time to this subject. We're going to talk about the history of racism in professional wrestling, particularly the WWE, if it still affects today's wrestling, and is it racist? I'm not the kind of white guy who's going to tell somebody else what's racist and what's not racist. I'm going to tell you what the facts are, and I might tell you how I feel personally, but it's a very slippery slope because racism is often in the eye of the beholder, and the beholder usually isn't somebody who is of the, you know, white persuasion, and much like sexism isn't really understood very well by people of the male persuasion. But I'm going to try to illuminate this issue, and maybe together we can find some things together that we agree upon or disagree upon, because let's not get too sensitive about this if you disagree, because reasonable people can disagree and be educated, and maybe we all can learn a little something. So that's what we're going to do this week on Total Engagement with me, Matt Kuhn, on the MLW Radio Network, partnered with WrestleZone, the world's most widely read internet wrestling website. There is no shortage of wrestling news in the world today. Whether you get on Twitter, or you go to ProWrestling.net, or you go to The Observer, you go to Torch, and a lot of it is contained in this world of WWE and the new upstart, AEW. And rightfully so. AEW has a TV deal on TNT. They're selling tickets like there's no tomorrow. Not as much as some people say, but an amazing amount of tickets are being sold for AEW, and they're really hitting the ground running, and I think they're going to be successful. And of course, the WWE, which is still the number one game in town, which is now completely financially viable for a long time because of these TV deals. And, you know, otherwise they might have some trouble because creatively there's some issues and there's some indicators with attendance. And of course, TV ratings, and no bigger indicator that they think there's an issue than hiring Bischoff and Heyman. But that's enough talk about WWE and AEW. There's other wrestling in the world going on, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about it, give you my take on it, and hopefully maybe expose you to a little bit different wrestling that maybe you can try and see what you think. I'm going to start with our partners here at MLW. Now, I know you probably might think because it's an MLW show, it's going to be MLW friendly. And the reality is that I'm going to say what I believe. If they didn't put out a good product, I wouldn't be talking about them. I don't even think Court listens to my show. Maybe he does. I hope he does, because I'm trying to do a great job for you, Court. But I am doing this of free will. Nobody flew me in to watch these shows, okay? I watched them on my own volition, and I decided to cover them based on my opinions. So starting with MLW, let me tell you about MLW. The booking is good. They have good guys. They have bad guys. They have young upstarts. They have some veterans, but they're not reliant on, you know, older names. The veterans they have are kind of guys creating new niches for themselves. And let's start with Teddy Hart. Teddy Hart, I think, is one of the great stories of the last couple of years. If you don't know Teddy Hart is, he is a Hart. He is part of the Hart family, one of the greatest wrestling families of all time. And when he was younger, he's kind of nuts, I think, and maybe kind of worked his way out of the wrestling world. But very quietly, he started working his way back in. And every time we see Teddy Hart wrestle, he is amazing. Teddy Hart could be a huge star on any platform of wrestling, WWE, AEW. He's a high flyer with size, with personality, with a gimmick that's real. You know, he has cats. He carries cats all the time. And the cat thing is for real. I've seen him with the cats, and he loves his cats. And people take pictures of him and the cats. It's fantastic. If you go on Instagram, anytime you see a fan take a picture with Teddy and his cat, Teddy's hand does not leave the cat. Also, interesting enough, Teddy wears pajamas all the time. He wears them in the airport. He wears them, you know, towards in the back. He wears these very comfortable pajamas. And I think, and I actually talked to this fella, and he's going to be on the show at some point, a guy who is a huge, huge up-and-coming star, Davey Boy Smith Jr. Now, you know him as, you know, Harry Smith, or I think they call him D.H. Smith, I think, in WWE. And he is someone who, whether he's in New Japan or whether he's in MLW, which is where he has an exclusive in the U.S., is getting better, bigger, really putting his game together, is a star. Speaking of stars, and I don't want to brush past Davey Boy Smith Jr. that quickly. If you just remember him from his WWE run, the dude is a veteran now, and he's fantastic. He is a guy with size. He's a guy with power. He really takes his profession seriously and is a student of the game. And again, part of the Hart Foundation, along with Brian Pillman Jr., another young star. I've talked about him a lot, interviewed him. He's a good friend of mine, but we'll talk about Brian another time. Again, we also had Tom Lawlor on the show. Tom Lawlor is a legit UFC fighter who is just the UFC champion. When you talk about stars, the quality of Davey Boy Smith and Teddy Hart, Tom Lawlor, you also have my Mance Warner is a fantastic young wrestler. Hammerstone is another great young wrestler. These are guys you need to be watching. These are guys you should know about. If you don't know them, Google them, check them out. But I want to talk about one guy that I think might be the future of wrestling in a lot of ways. His name is Jacob Fatu. Fatu. And if you, of course, you know that name, Fatu, he is part of the Samoan family. I don't know how to pronounce the name, Anoa'i family. But in the Anoa'i family, there's three brothers. There was three brothers. One passed, of course. One's name was Umaga. The other's name was Rikishi. And the other name was the Tonga Kid. Tonga Kid was someone I thought was awesome when I was a kid. Rikishi, of course, you all know. Umaga, you all know. Umaga passed away a few years ago. So those three brothers, Umaga, Tonga Kid, and Rikishi, comprise the Fatu part of the Anoa'i family. And the sons of Rikishi are the Uso brothers. So the Usos just signed with WWE for a few more years. They're going to be around for a long time. They're one of the great tag teams of all time. Umaga didn't have kids in wrestling, although he was like a second dad to the Usos. But the Tonga Kid, who also wrestled later as Tama in the Islanders and the Samoan Savage, he has a son, and his name is Jacob Fatu. And in talking to a couple Samoans, a couple Fatus, let me just say, when talking to them, one of them told me, hey, you know, the whole family used to talk, and we used to say, you know, Umaga. Umaga's the one. Umaga's going to be the star. Umaga is the talented one. He is the superstar of the family. But now we know it's Jacob. Because Jacob is fucking awesome. You've got to see this guy. He's not as tall as a lot of Samoans. I think he's probably 5'11", 6 feet tall. He is a big guy, a lot like Tonga Kid is now. Not like Tonga Kid when he was younger, when he was very skinny. He is so very agile, so very quick, so very powerful. He does a version of the triple jump moonsault, and it's about the most amazing thing you've ever seen. Jacob Fatu is someone you need to keep your eyes out for. With the booking and the TV, the organization, the leadership of Court Bauer, and all these stars, whether you're talking about Jacob Fatu, Tom Lawler, Teddy Hart, Davey Boy Smith Jr., my man Mance Warner, who will be on the show one day, and of course, Hammerstone, you've got, and there's a couple guys I'm forgetting because there's so many, you've got the makings of a organization that's on the up and up. They are coming up, and you better be ready for them. If you're not, you can check them out on BNTV, or you can check out their shows on YouTube. They're going to have their first pay-per-view. I would get it. And once again, I don't say that because this show is an MLW show. I say that because I am so impressed with what they're doing, and I think it's underappreciated, and people need to know. Now, speaking of underappreciated, Impact Wrestling, TNA, how many different variations, how many different lives have we gone through with this damn company? You know, I remember it started, my son's 17 years old. And when he was born, a day after he was born, I went home. I had to let the dogs out and stuff. And, you know, my wife was still in the hospital overnight. And I ordered, I believe, their second pay-per-view they ever had for TNA. So we're talking, it's 17 years. And we've seen all the reiterations all the way from Russo and Jarrett through Anthem and Dixie and, you know, another Jeff Jarrett time. And now we have this kind of new Impact Wrestling, and they've been putting on some really good pay-per-views. I haven't been watching the weekly show, but I think I'm going to start because they've been bringing in some new agents, really good agents who have done a really good job. I watched the recent Slammiversary, and I was very impressed with the tag team match. Of course, LAX, I believe, are no longer with the company as of that show. But not only that, you had Michael Elgin versus Brian Cage. These are two big, strong stars. Almost harken back to yesteryear, big guys, but they can wrestle. They can move, they can fly, they can go, and they understand wrestling, and any match with them is entertaining, and they're feuding with each other, and they're just monsters, and really entertaining match they had. Then they had Tessa Blanchard, of course. Tessa Blanchard is Tully Blanchard's daughter, but raised, for the most part, by Magnum TA. I know, that's weird, but it is what it is. Who has become a great wrestler in her own right, to the point where she's doing the intergender thing. And we talked about the intergender wrestling with Joey Ryan. I tend to agree with him when he said, I'm not going to say, this is Joey Ryan saying, I'm not going to say in a make-believe world, we can't tell women they're not equal to us. I tend to agree. They had one of the best intergender matches, maybe the best intergender match I've ever seen. I think Another great intergender match I saw was the Young Bucks versus Candice LeRae and Joey Ryan at for PWG, but this one was the best one I ever saw. And the big mistake I think Impact made, and hopefully it'll be correct in the future, I think they're telling a long story. I was told they're telling a long story with this, but I believe Tessa should have won. Because right now in wrestling, you've got not that many opportunities to make a big splash, not that many stories to get ahead of, not that many ways to get your name out there. Impact can rebrand itself under Tessa. Tessa is the person, is, you know, what we say, Tessa's the guy, Tessa's the man, but Tessa is it. Tessa's everything that Becky Lynch tries to be. And I think she should have won that match. Also, I think Sami Callihan is fantastic. He's a great heel, a great wrestler, and I also think of a good person. And I will definitely start watching the weekly show and stop making fun of them for all their technological glitches that they've had lately. They're not, man, I tell you, Impact won't die. And now the wrestling is better than it's been in a long time. So if you like professional wrestling, if you like good storytelling, check out Impact Wrestling. Of course, we had New Japan, the G1, and I am a newer G1 fan, a newer New Japan fan. I'm a new Japan fan. I've been a fan for maybe a year and a half. I think I just came over like a lot of people did with the Elite. Once we started hearing about Okada and Omega, and then we started hearing about the Elite, a lot of us got on New Japan World and started watching these kingdoms and started watching the G1s and all the different specials. I saw the New Japan and Ring of Honor match or card at Madison Square Garden, and I've become kind of a big fan of New Japan wrestling. I really dig it all. I wish, if I could say that I'd like something different, I wish they had more storylines, you know, more of a soap opera feel. I've always liked that about wrestling. I think in wrestling that draws, but the matches are fantastic. I know people think I might be a Will Ospreay fanboy, but watch that damn match. He had a match over the weekend with Lance Archer. Lance Archer, formerly Lance Hoyt from TNA, part of the tag teams and many different iterations in TNA. He has developed, much like Davey Boy Smith has, into a fantastic wrestler. He and Lance Archer had a great match. Ospreay and Lance Archer had a great match. Okada is something to see. Now, if you're not watching New Japan, you have to know that people like Meltzer, especially Meltzer, it just goes without saying, Okada's the best in the world. Okada's amazing. And watch him. He's really good. He does have star quality. He is a big guy, 6'2 or so. He's got a good physique, a great look. His drop kick is the best drop kick anybody has ever seen, ever. And his matches have psychology. It was something that Russo and I used to argue about, where the storyline is inside the match. I said I would like maybe some more storylines outside the match, but the storyline is inside the match, and you can see they really work to make it a realistic match. Now, the criticism to that is that they take a lot of heavy hits, a lot of big risks, and a lot of times they don't sell the way you could. But I think as far as where that line is of having impactful stuff going on and selling and having it be realistic, but at the same time, maybe getting as much wow factor in there, I don't think you can really find a better mix than what New Japan has. I'm not like Meltzer, where I go, well, it's the greatest wrestling in the world, hands down. There's no ifs, ands, or buts, but I do really enjoy it a lot. I think other matches, seeing Zack Sabre Jr. Zack Sabre Jr. Had a match with, let me think here, Sonata. Now, Sonata, you might know as Sonata from Impact. He has grown into, he had a role on Impact as the great Muda's protege. And now he has become a great wrestler in his own right. And Zack Sabre Jr. is someone, at first, you might be like, what the fuck? He looks like he's about 5'10". He probably weighs about 150 pounds. He's very skinny. But he's developed this shoot style of wrestling and submissions and counters the submissions. An escape artist. And I wasn't a fan of him at first. He grew on me. And man, now I look forward to Zack Sabre match because it is very realistic looking. It is very MMA-like. It's like if MMA was a work and they could make it as entertaining as they could. If you haven't seen Zack Sabre Jr., check him out. I'm not a guy who's just like a big New Japan mark who liked him the first time I saw him. I'm telling you, though, I saw a match with him WrestleCon weekend, and it was, I believe it was Shane Strickland, and it was one of the best matches that I've ever seen in person. Something else I saw, with New Japan, the one thing about it is that the attendance sucked. Now, we can't ignore the fact the attendance sucked. They did not book, I think it was the American Airlines Arena, to draw 5,000 people. They booked it to draw 12,000 people, and they only drew 5,000 people. As good as the crowd was, it was what one might say a disappointment. Let's not pretend it's not. There's a couple reasons for that. I believe that the popularity of New Japan was really bolstered by Omega and the Elite, and the fact that they're not there hurts. Number two, New Japan, the way they book, they don't announce matches until a couple weeks out. So if they were able to announce their matches a few months out, that would make all the difference in the world. If they could have promoted Will Ospreay versus Lance Archer 4 months ahead, or Okada versus Tanahashi 4 months ahead, they would have gotten a lot more buys there. So there's a couple things at work. I think they need to book small arenas, which they're doing. And it relates to something we're going to talk about in a second. They announced they're doing Hammerstein Ballroom, which is a smaller place. You've seen Raw there. And the 2300 Arena, you may know it as ECW Arena. If you're in the Northeast, those sound like fun shows. I think I might go to both. They're definitely going to sell out. And something interesting is that they announced that Mike Johnson broke that there's no Ring of Honor association with these New Japan Pro Wrestling shows. I know there's been some real disappointment among New Japan wrestlers in regards to Ring of Honor. The lifeblood thing, the booking, the fact that there is a talent disparity, what happened at MSG where it was really an opportunity to change the world, but instead it was kind of blown because the Ring of Honor stuff just went over like a lead balloon, or as Tony Schiavone would say, a fart in church. And New Japan Wrestling not using Ring of Honor in the Northeast, which is kind of their area, and not using them in Philly and New York, which is kind of their area, I think that's a big deal. And I think it's a story that's been buried a little bit, not buried in the wrestling sense, but buried in the traditional journalist sense, that maybe this is something that's signaling something towards the end, or the end of the New Japan Pro Wrestling Ring of Honor relationship. New Japan would be well served to have a American partner who can give to them as much as they give to that partner. And I don't know if Ring of Honor's carried that weight. I'm going to say they haven't. The last event I want to talk about that I watched this weekend was GCW. Now, GCW is a little bit different. It's popularized by Joey Janela, and the owner, Brett Lauderdale, has done a great job of creating a real grassroots organization that is probably the closest thing to ECW that you'll find in wrestling today. It's very underground. It is kind of hip and cool. It does really good as far as Fight TV, and does really good as far as getting streams and drawing and making their money and paying their wrestlers and getting bigger and bigger crowds. They sold out events in Japan, and it is indie wrestling. Absolutely. You have people like Janela, and they have like Orange Cassidy and, you know, the indie stars of today. Marco Stunt, people like that. They're really maybe the top, I'd call, indie promotion in the world right now is GCW. They had something called a backyard wrestling show on July 4th. My son really wanted to watch it. I'm like, motherfucker, we're at the beach. I am not ordering a goddamn pay-per-view at the beach. And guess what happened? It started fucking raining. And he looks at me 2 days after his birthday. Dad, I'm like, fuck, okay, fine. So we watched this thing. It was nuts. I don't know if I loved it or I hated it. I do know I was entertained by it. I don't like wrestlers destroying themselves. I don't like wrestlers hurting themselves. I do like spectacular, innovative, fun, quirky, interesting ideas. And at the same time, this whole backyard wrestling phenomenon that started decades ago created some of the greatest wrestlers in the world today. whether it be Will Ospreay or whether it be, you know, Mick Foley, and whether it be the Hardy Brothers. Backyard wrestling has now, 20 years later, has a cachet. And the fact they're taking it back to the backyard wrestling is really smart. Now, this fucking thing was in a neighborhood. It was in a backyard. So let me just describe this enough if you didn't see it. There was a ring outside in a backyard. Maybe about 100 people there drinking beer. Some wrestlers hanging out. Nick Cage doing commentary. You couldn't really hear him. I did text him and tell him that I couldn't hear him, and I felt I might have made a mistake because he might kill me next time I see him. But hey, if you guys in GCW need a commentator, give me a holler because I'd love to do it. But it was in the backyard, and next to the ring was a trampoline. On the other side of the ring was another trampoline. And on the other side, and on the other side of that trampoline was an outdoor pool. All of these things were used for the wrestling matches. There was lots of light tubes. There were lots of doors. Tables aren't really a thing anymore. I guess Brian Alvarez said you can't buy tables the way you used to at Home Depot, so you just buy doors. For the most part, people lit themselves on fire. People jumped off high fucking things and did crazy moves, you know, 630s outside the ring onto the ground, shooting star presses off of the roofs of buildings onto the ground, a fall through scaffolding that was obviously built that day, a fight inside of a house that made its way out to the window, suplexes into a pool, suplexes onto a door in a pool, setting yourself on fire and jumping into a pool, brother on brother, almost little person fighting. You had it all. I'm not sure if I loved it just because I hate to see wrestlers get hurt. So there was a couple instances with the light tubes where there was some wrestlers really who got butchered, I would say. I don't think anybody got seriously hurt in the sense of broken bones. And I respect these guys for doing this stuff. It looks like it fucking hurts. It's dedication. I don't know if it's my thing. I got to be honest with you. I think Janela's great. I think Nick Cage is great. Nick Cage is not great. Nick Gage is great. If I said Nick Cage earlier, sorry, Nick. Nick Gage is fantastic. Nick Cage, the stunts are, you know, stunts are pretty good. Marco and Logan wrestle each other. And all these young wrestlers who were doing these high-flying moves. But I don't know. It's for me, man. There's just too much margin for error. I don't mind the goofy stuff, the pool stuff, the trampoline stuff. But the light tubes and the fire and the jumping off of high spaces and just demolishing your bodies. If you're into that, you should check it out. I'll probably watch GCW again. I don't know if I'd order a backyard wrestling if my son wasn't there, but I understand it does really well, and it's worth a watch if you've never seen it before. They work their asses off. They create a good product, and it is a grassroots show. So we talked about MLW, Impact, New Japan Pro Wrestling, the issues with Ring of Honor these days, and GCW. And right after this, we're going to talk about a fun subject, racism in wrestling. Now, I made light of how fun talking about race is, but it is a serious subject. It's a serious subject in society. It's a serious subject in wrestling. And it's something that people are very sensitive to. People of color who've traditionally been the brunt of racism, you know, are rightfully sensitive on the issue. And for some reason, white people are too. And white people get really bent out of shape of false cries of racism. It's one of the funniest things in the world to me that a white person is more upset about false claims of racism, what they see as false claims of racism, than they are actual racism. So for the purposes of this, if you don't believe racism exists, you can go ahead and turn off the podcast now, because guys, it's the fucking world. Okay. Look at the goddamn world. Look at the history. Okay. That being said, I'm going to go with facts, so we can always just, you know, editorialize, and I might editorialize a little bit later, but I'm going to try to be as fact-based as I can and let you decide if there is some merit to criticisms recently about racism in the WWE. Now, you don't know what I'm talking about. There was a Twitter argument recently between Ron Funches, who has been on the show, and someone I like, someone I know, someone I respect, and Hurricane Shane Helms, someone I don't know that well, but I've met once. I did a podcast with him once. I think he's hilarious. I think he's funny. I think that means the same thing. He's smart and usually progressive in his views. I've heard him debate Disco Inferno on several matters, and usually Disco takes the kind of right-wing approach and Hurricane takes the left-wing approach. And in this particular exchange with Ron Funches, he was uncharacteristically not left-wing, and I think Funches felt that it was because what he called was a company guy. And it just started with, you know, someone saying, please, or Hurricane tweeted, we'd love to have LAX, the tag team from Impact, in WWE. That'd be great. They're awesome. And Funches wrote, please, no. You'd have them riding lawnmowers. And it just went from that. You know, Hurricane said, what about Ray or Eddie? And it got personal. But I think Funches has a point, because Funches later said, which was released on his podcast, I think yesterday, and check out Ron Funches' podcast, Getting Better. Check out Hurricane's podcast. Joe Feeney does it. It's fantastic. Forget the name of it. I've listened to it a couple times, but he's great too. But on Funches' podcast, he talks about the fact that as a black man himself, it was important for him to see great black role models, and that he doesn't see that in WWE today. When you have someone like R-Truth who doesn't know what day it is, when you have the fact that 80% of the wrestlers either dance to the ring, playing, which is, in his words, playing traditional, stereotypical, racist, black, minstrel-type entertainment, blackface, almost, characters, either play off of that or black fear stereotypes. And, you know, there's a point to that. I remember having a conversation with a big, big wrestling insider a couple years ago, and I made that point. I said, can you name a black wrestler in WWE who doesn't dance to the ring? And they said, oh my God, you're right. So there's something there. But let's go to the history of racism in wrestling, and then particularly WWE, and then see maybe if there's something to worry about, if there's something to this. So to break it down, wrestling was a segregated sport, was a segregated activity. And it segregated to the point where there were black-type, Negro League-type organizations that just had black wrestlers. And eventually, when the wrestling organizations were integrated, for the most part, 99% of the time, you had black wrestlers facing black wrestlers and black wrestlers partnering with black wrestlers. That was in part because white wrestlers didn't want to be touched by black wrestlers, and also white people didn't want to see black wrestlers interact with white wrestlers. But that started changing. In the 60s, Bobo Brazil became NWA World Champion. And things started changing. You saw more and more, it kind of mirrors the civil rights movement in a way where, you know, slavery ended, but you had Jim Crow. And segregation ended, but you had more entrenched racism. It kind of reflected that, in that wrestling got more integrated, but you still saw a lot of these stereotypes. When I started watching wrestling, my first favorite tag team was called the Soul Patrol. So it's two black guys, Tony Atlas and Rocky Johnson. I remember him going, me and Rocky going all the way. And, you know, I didn't think anything of the fact that their gimmick was that they were black. And really, that was it. But they were great. And I thought, I was very upset when they lost the tag team titles to Adonis and Murdoch. At the same time, you had Roddy Piper having Piper's Pit and having interviews with Tony Atlas where he just talks to him about soul food. That's all he talks to him about. And Atlas just played the dumb guy and just said, yeah, I like that food. I like pig's feet. I like chicken. Piper at the same time had incidents with Jimmy Snuka on Piper's Pit. We all know about the coconut, but don't forget about the fact in the same segment, he's shoving bananas in his face. And I believe he said something like, monkey want a banana, something like that. He fed a poster of Mr. T bananas and had a few racial, you know, things to say about Mr. T. We had Jesse the Body Ventura, who became a governor, who is one of the greatest wrestling announcers of all time. But we gloss over the fact that he did use race as a way to create his heat. Now, whether you think that's acceptable or not, that's up to you. But Tito Santana's name is not Chico. He's not a taco vendor. And these are things Jesse said. When he said Junkyard Dog, who is a wrestler who, I mean, think about it, man. He's a wrestler that basically his gimmick is he dances and he's got chains around his neck. Whatever. That's what we're seeing. And Jesse saying he looks like he's walking around with a mouthful of grits. Coco, beware, Jesse Ventura. Instead of, you know, maybe talking about he was short or something, he called them buckwheat. Eventually stopped. Of course, we know we had Kamala, you know, who is, you know, played off of, he's a savage. The Samoans and all these a lot of these ethnic wrestlers I've already named, from Tony Atlas to the Samoans to Mr. T, Junkyard Dog. If you headbutted them, it had no effect. If you headbutted a black wrestler or Samoan wrestler, it was stupid because they had harder heads. They had thicker, harder heads. That was the narrative. If you want to go further, what does that mean? What does that mean if you have a thicker, harder head? That if I headbutt you in the head where your brain is, it has no effect on you. But a matter of fact, it plays to your strength, which is your hard head. But me, if I headbutt you and you're a Samoan or a black wrestler, I happen to get hurt. What does that narrative mean? That narrative stuck around for a very long time, by the way. A very long time. Of course, moving along through history, we had the Million Dollar Man, who had Virgil. And Virgil, in Million Dollar Man's first vignette, he said he owns Virgil. Owns him. And Virgil responds, yes, sir. You had Akeem, the African Dream, which was the one-man gang. I still never really understood why they did it. Bruce Pritchard swears it was not a rib on Dusty Rhodes, even though he acted like Dusty. But he said, you know, the gimmick was he came from deepest, darkest Africa. And deepest, darkest Africa. Deepest, darkest Africa. And then he spoke in, you know, what you might call a black scent. He spoke in jive talk, not like Dusty, where Dusty Rhodes was someone who grew up in kind of a multicultural area and was really emulating and ripping off, but emulating black wrestlers he grew up watching. It was a white guy saying he's from Africa who's acting black. Okay, so it's the 80s. We can say that was a long time ago. Sure. It's a lot like slavery. People say it was a long time ago, but people knew slavery was wrong then. There was countries that had outlawed slavery by then, and there were people back then who knew that this kind of thing might not be a good thing or an acceptable thing. Fast forwarding a little bit, Tony Atlas, who was this just, you know, Greek god-looking guy, you know, he just was just the physique on him. And they said he found his roots and he turned into Saba Simba. And he was African, basically, and wore tribal gear. And, of course, let's not forget Charles Wright, whose gimmicks included, of course, being in the Nation of Domination. Papa Shango, who's a witch doctor, as well as, you know, of course, a pimp, the Godfather, which a lot of people think that Slick, who managed Akeem, was also maybe acting like a pimp. Once again, by themselves, I don't know if they're racist, but if your gimmick is, if you come in as a black wrestler and your gimmick is you're black, let's do something with this black thing. Is that racist? That's the question. You know, when we have a WCW tag team called Harlem Heat, and of course we are going to talk a little bit more about Booker later, is, you know, when they show up saying that Colonel Tom Parker, Robert Parker, won them in a poker game, and they're wearing chains around their neck, and he's definitely a plantation owner. Guys, we all know this stuff. But when someone's saying it to you, it's fucked up. If I had someone sitting here who was not a wrestling fan, and I said, okay, so these two African-American wrestlers, had chains on him. They were brought to a guy in an all white outfit, and he talked like an old Southerner, and he said he owned them. Is that, you know, racist? And, you know, I don't know. Of course, they ditched the chains and wore prison outfits instead. Now we're talking about, you know, the mid-90s. Of course, in the late 90s, we had the Attitude Era. We had the Nation of Domination. We had the Luchadors in WCW. Of course, it's a slippery slope because some people do want to embrace their culture, embrace what they are, who they are. And part of that might very well be embracing something that other people might view as stereotypes. When someone like Harley Race talks about Ron Simmons and says, you know, when I was a world champion, I had a boy like you carry me bags. When you had Bill Watts removed from working for WCW for saying, you know, things like he should have the right to hire people based on race, then you have a systemic issue. When you have a WCW lawsuit based on race where millions of dollars was allegedly handed out because people backstage were using racial terms, you've got a systemic issue. We're talking about real racism, racism that isn't just like hurting someone's feelings, racism that's affecting incomes. Down there, you know, we had the Nation of Domination. Nation of Domination might very well just be a gimmick of black empowerment, you know, but again, it's like we have a black wrestler. What do we do with him? Well, let's go with this black thing. We have so many different wrestlers that came in that when you just embraced their race and went off their race as their gimmick. Too Cold Scorpio is one of the best freaking wrestlers I've ever seen. He's always dancing, always, you know, I don't even know what Flash Funk was. I think he's supposed to be Eddie Guerrero, Lie, Cheat, and Steal. I still don't understand what the fuck that was. I still don't know. I mean, I guess it got over, but the idea is that he's a good guy. He's a Mexican who lies, cheats, and steal, and it's funny, and it's cool, haha. But that's who the young Hispanic Americans are watching. Like, that's the one WWE point to as their standard bearer of racial equality is a guy who talked in an exaggerated Hispanic accent and said he was a liar, cheater, and stealer. We had Crime Time, and I've talked to JTG, I've met Shad Gaspar. They're nothing like those characters, and I believe they came up with that gimmick. It doesn't mean WWE should have allowed it, because I'm not sure what that was. It was a situation of, these guys are thieves. These guys are criminals. They're playing off of negative stereotypes. Why can't a black wrestler be an IRS? Why can't a black wrestler be an MVP? Or why does it have to be Saba Simba? It just keeps going on and on. And you know, we're still talking now about, you know, now 20 years ago. Less than 20 years ago, we had the Mexicools, three of the greatest luchadors in the history of wrestling. Hoovy, Psicosis, Super Crazy. They rode fucking lawnmowers to the ring. Lawnmowers. My son did not believe me when I told him that there was a tag to that. I was like, did these guys ever wrestle WWE? I go, oh yeah, they fucking did. Really? I go, yeah, they rode lawnmowers. He goes, no, they didn't. I go, let me show you. I actually tweeted that, and a big wrestling writer, one of the most well-known wrestling writers, DM'd me and said that his significant other didn't believe him when he said they rode lawnmowers to the ring. For years and years and years, decades and decades, there's a tradition of racism that's more insensitive than the surrounding culture. You wouldn't find, at the same time of the Attitude Era, a choppy chip, choppy pee-pee type caricature in movies or TV outside of wrestling. You wouldn't find something like the Mexicools in a movie or TV show in 2004, 2005, 2006. Okay, so how about now? If Ron tweets, hey, I don't think you're going to be sensitive to race when it comes to these guys. I like LAX the way they are. I don't want them to be fucking treated badly. Well, it's 2019, man. This is a different company now. So let's fast forward a little bit then, because the situation we're talking about is LAX in 2019. If LAX has a reason to feel that they would be marginalized racially or not in today's WWE, we're not talking about 20 years ago. We're talking about now. And does Ron have a point that LAX might get marginalized, might be treated racially insensitively in today's WWE? Well, recently, within the last couple of years, you had Jinder Mahal, who of course was a Indian wrestler, but he's Canadian, really. He just of Indian descent, who embraced the fact that, hey, he looks Indian, so that's who he is. That's his gimmick. You know, he had matches and had a program with Mr. Shinsuke Nakamura, and he made fun of his accent. He said, "You always look the same. They call you Mr. Miyagi." And they did martial arts poses. The audience was really confused. You could hear it on TV. People say that's racist. And then later on, people would chant, "That's too far. That's too far." That's not that long ago. Of course, in this meantime, I've skipped over a few things, like Vince McMahon saying the N-word in front of Booker T. The N-word in front of Booker T, and Booker T said, "Tell me he didn't just say that." And, of course, the Triple H Booker, program, where it's a lot of you people and nappy hair and all this stuff, which stuff that doesn't belong anywhere. And back then, it was terrible. I remember watching that and thinking, this is so very racist. Once again, I'm not trying to editorialize, but Jesus Christ. If it's postured as that, and Booker gets the win, it's cool. But after all that, I believe after Triple H hit him with his finisher, it took him 27 seconds to cover him to get the win. After all that, there was so much. Anyway, skipping over that, you know, we had the Jinder Mahal situation. We also had a situation in 2014 where Alberto Del Rio was fired. Now, Alberto Del Rio was fired because he slapped someone named Cody, who he said made a racist joke at his expense, who worked for WWE, about the fact that he's Alberto Del Rio, or someone's cleaning off their plate. I think he was cleaning off his own plate, this Cody guy, and said Alberto should do it. And then when Alberto heard about it, he slapped him, and then he was fired for it. And they said that WWE said that it was unprofessional. He's responsible for LAX. There's no excuse for it. But what Del Rio said is that, quote, "We always get these racist jokes from WWE employees, and I've never been happy about it. I didn't say anything because most of the people doing these racist jokes were important people in the company." And he said it wasn't just him. It was all the Latino elements in the company, the African-Americans. And he also said that when he got the phone call telling him that he was being let go, he said it was one of the most important people in the company. Alberto Del Rio said he always heard he said he told him, quote, "We always hear these racist jokes from you. And because you're one of the most important people in the company, in this company, your other employees hear you making these stupid comments and they think they can do it. When they hear you doing these racist comments all the time and we don't say anything because it is you, now those guys think they can go make those stupid comments." And as reported in Uproxx, that statement is significant because Alberto has explicitly stated in the past, in past interviews, that phone call was with Triple H. Of course, Alberto's sidekick there, Ricardo Rodriguez, said that Triple H called him Bumblebee. He called him Bumblebee, and I've heard that he called other Hispanic wrestlers Bumblebee after the Bumblebee character in The Simpsons. Now, again, it's one thing in front of the camera when your gimmick is your race. It's another thing when it's behind the camera and people are marginalizing you and people are insulting you and people are demeaning you and diminishing you with these racist terms, if true. I don't know why Alberto would slap this guy, and there was no pushback from the WWE saying that these racist comments didn't happen. So, okay, well, these were a couple years ago, 2014. And then we also had something a couple years ago involving Jinder Mahal. What about Lars Sullivan and Leo Rush? Lars Sullivan said a bunch of racist shit on a message board. People, I found out about it while he was with NXT. I'm like, why isn't this a fucking story? This guy's a racist. And then he was brought to WWE, and then people kind of, they took fire, you know, because he was had a bigger platform, had a bigger name, and people started, getting attention at these racist comments he made. And things like, if we're going off of scientific facts, obviously, whether Hispanic or Black women, who pops out the most babies at the youngest age? Hispanics followed by Blacks. Why do 50% of Black women have STDs? Sluts. I don't know what that means. He said, what are Kofi and R-Truth supposed to be? A PG Black Panther stable? I always wondered why they had to team up two Black guys. Both those guys look like they could be in a prison Black gang. These are things that he said. He said not to be racist, by the way. When someone says not to be racist, just fucking brace for something super fucking racist to come out of their mouth. Not to be racist, but it seems like white people are more willing to take responsibility for their own lives than Blacks and Hispanics, who are all for government handouts. This is what Lars Sullivan said. Now, Lars Sullivan, once it became an issue for WWE, meaning people found out about it, then they fined him, but he was still on TV. He was still on TV. He was at the Saudi deal, beating up the three Hispanic wrestlers, who, by the way, come to the fucking ring with piñatas. Sorry. That's what they do. They come to the ring with piñatas. I don't know what the fucking means. I just see some white guy going, just give him some piñatas. That's fun. And also, Lars coming out and just destroying guys like Almas and R-Truth and No Way Jose and Rey Mysterio and the Lucha House Party, that's a gimmick, I guess. I don't know. I don't think it's exclusively minorities, but seems to be quite a few. At the same time, Leo Rush, who was fucking killing it as Bobby Lashley's side, a heater, like small heater, who, his mouthpiece, I guess, and a guy who really helped get Lashley over after their tremendously terrible debut with him talking about his sisters and all that shit. He said that he lost his prominent role on Raw, lost a role according to Uproxx, because he refused to fetch water and carry bags for more experienced talent. When Sean Ross Sapp reached out to him from Fightful.com, highly recommended, Leo Rush, real name Lionel Green, defended himself by pointing out that, quote, a Black kid carrying waters and bags for other wrestlers is just not a good look, especially when I'm trying to portray myself as a superstar as well. It seems like a really big double standard to me. I don't know. Is it a double standard? Like, a guy is let go because he's not carrying bags, and he's kind of harkening back to a racial issue where it looks bad for a young Black man to be carrying bags for these guys when he's a superstar. Now, just put yourself in his shoes before you go off and you say, well, fucking young wrestlers on this for old wrestlers forever. Put yourself in his shoes. And put yourself in the shoes of what having a guy like Lars in a prominent position, and that basically he's being let go for refusing to do this. Looking at the current roster, it does seem like, compared to the white guys, the non-white guys have a gimmick that is race-related. For the most part, a much larger plurality of people of color have their race as their gimmick, as opposed to people of not color. I think you have Sheamus. I mean, his gimmick was that he's from, Ireland. But it's not like with, Finn Balor, that's his gimmick. It's like, oh, well, he's from freaking Europe, or he's from Scotland, and I don't know where the hell he's from, but Ireland or Scotland, and that's who he is. He's going to come to the ring with a flag, and he's going to speak in the accent, and he's going to be a drunk, because Irish people drink a lot. That's not the instinct. So I just want you to think about that. When you think about race, white people, let's think about race just a little bit. And don't be so sensitive to it. Don't be so defensive of it. Realize that people of color might have a good point when they object to these things. And, when you want to go after people like me and say we're social justice warriors or whatever, just think about, this is how I really feel. This is how it's something that hits me. When I saw R-Truth, I'm just like, oh man, that's something that hits me. It's my opinion. And if I'm going to say If I'm going to editorialize, I'm going to say that, yeah, I don't think the WWE is a racially sensitive place. I don't think it's reflective of how racially sensitive society is, and I don't think society is as racially sensitive or racially equal as it should be. That is my opinion. And I come by my opinion just to give a little background, little tiny bit of background, is that at the age of 4, I moved to Nigeria, Africa. My first friends I ever had, and I think of a kid when you have friends, you love these people. You know, the first people I loved that weren't my family were people of a different race, a different color, different religion, different culture. So by the time I came back to the States 3 years later, I think I had different experiences than a lot of other kids did. Some of the best, my best friends I've ever had and the people I look up to the most personally, whether it be Victor Wooten or Anthony Wellington, who's a great bass teacher, someone I look up to a lot, Joseph Wooten, who's someone I think is just the greatest. He's the keyboardist for the Steve Miller Band. And these are people that I look up to as mentors. I don't think I have any. If I count my mentors, you know, I would say they're Victor and Anthony, Joseph, and probably Conrad. So, you know, that's, my world is maybe a little more multicultural than most white people. My previous job before I worked teaching music was I worked for the Boys and Girls Clubs of America. I worked for the Boys and Girls Clubs of Metro Richmond, and I ran Boys and Girls Clubs. I had my own club. I was the unit director for more than one club in the housing projects of Richmond, Fairfield Court, and Creighton, Gilpin Court. I also worked at other Boys and Girls Clubs on my way up to those positions where our customers, the kids, were 100% African-American. I would like to say I think I have a little more of a full viewpoint of those kind of racial issues than most white people do. I'm not saying it makes me an expert. I'm just giving you context that I'm not just like some white dude sitting here saying things that I'm just making up off the top of my head. And when I was working with these kids, when Barack Obama was elected president, it was a big thing for these kids because for the first time in their life, when they look at a wall of presidents, these kids in the housing projects, I remember this one kid, Boo Man, and he was one of the most spectacular kids I ever met, smart, go-getter. 14 years old, I met him. We became kind of close, and he became a drug dealer in that area, and he got murdered later on. And if you Google the word Boo Man and Matt Coon, you might find a newspaper article or two on it. And I remember telling him, I would go, Clarence, because I would never call him Boo Man. I call him Clarence. Clarence, you can be anything you want to be. You have all these gifts. And he'd look at me like I was the stupidest fucking guy in the world. Say, Mr. Matt, what the fuck are you talking about? I said, dude, you can be anything. You can get out of here. And he didn't see anything beyond the projects that he lived in. But I'm telling you, when you put up that picture of Barack Obama for those kids, whether you like him or not, whether your politics agree with him or not, and you had these young black kids looking up to this guy and saying, holy shit, maybe I can do that one day. It was huge. And it brought to mind to me as a white guy, like the importance of modeling, the importance of people who look like you and learning your history and looking at a wall of white presidents and saying, and having black skin and going, well, that's not for me. And to parallel that with wrestling, these young African-American kids today, or these young Hispanic kids or Asian kids, when they're watching television, let's give them some good role models. Let's not make Titus O'Neil the fucking exception. Let's not rack our brains to think of wrestlers who, black wrestlers who don't have to dance to the ring. Let's not rack our brains to think of Hispanic wrestlers that aren't feeding stereotypes. Let's not necessarily just make someone's, you know, like we talked about before with Sonny Kiss, oh, they're gay. What the hell are they doing in here? They're so weird looking. Or, oh, they're black, so let's make them Saba Simba. Or they're Asian, so let's go choppy choppy pee pee. Or they're Mexican, so let's put them on lawnmowers. We're fucking better than that. Let's demand better than that. And let's not get all fucking bent out of shape when one black comedian says, hey, your company doesn't have a very good history. I don't think you can be trusted. I think it's fair. That's my opinion. Let me know what you think. Please give me a 5-star review. Unless you're racist. If you're racist, like, don't review the show, please. But if you're not a racist, please give me a 5-star review on iTunes. And also interact with me on Twitter. I can be a dick sometimes. It's because I get so many fucking trolls. So if I'm a dick to you, just like say, hey, Matt, you're being a dick. I'm just trying to talk. Because sometimes someone will say something shitty and I'll just be just a total dick. So I apologize for that. I hope this show's been entertaining. I hope it's been educational. I hope it's been well received. I can't thank you guys enough for listening to this fucking weird podcast from a guy who's a wrestling fan just like you. I'll see you at the shows, guys. This is Total Engagement with Matt Kuhn, brought to you on the MLW Radio Network, partnered with WrestleZone, the most widely read wrestling news site on the planet.